It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's late July in Alabama. How do I know that? I know that because, listen here, I know that because I'm starting to plant all my fall vegetables in the middle of this heat. Yes, sir. That's what we do. That's how it works. That's how you're going to succeed. You call me if you don't understand how that works. Listen to those seeds. Isn't that nice to hear? And they're being put into little containers right now. They're being watered. If you need to know how to protect them, you give me a call. You know, I know it's also summer because, and it's late July, because my legs looks like I have the measles. My stomach looks like I have the measles. I don't even want to talk about. It's the chigger season. Oh, heavens to Betsy. So if you hear me scream, please forgive me. It's just the chiggers. If you don't know what chiggers are, give me a call. And, you know, I don't know how many people are out there because it's that time of year when those who have the wherewithal, oh, they flee to the Cotswolds in England to spend some cool days. Let's hope it's cool in the Cotswolds for those folks. Or they go up to Scotland to golf, whatever. And I'm thinking a lot about that, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm just here in Alabama. In fact, I am almost my entire life here in Alabama, except for that place, time I spent in that far, far away place called Mississippi. And there was a time in North Carolina and a little time in California, but hardly enough to speak about. So I'm here, and I'm thinking about where we are, and I think it's always good for you to think about where we are, but you also got to know that a lot of us spend our vacations in the Cotswolds, and I think the reason for that is that that is where our head is. It's absolutely amazing. You know, it's like we have to go to the Cotswolds, which are this area in southwest England, where I think some prominent people right now are vacationing. And it's, you know, it's, there's some interesting things about the Cotswolds. Jane Austen's novels were set there. Tolkien's sort of became the model for Tolkien's Shire in Lord of the Rings. We know it as this kind of literary place that we hear about in England. It's low hills. You know, it's a place where 2 out of 3 voters are sheep, right? That's the Cotswolds. We kind of know that. We know about it distantly. I can't say I have a huge familiarity with it personally, but it is in our heads all the time. And so, like the golf course links in Scotland. And so when we go to say, oh, what should a Mobile landscape look like? And I was asked this lately in a very important way. We'll see. We may hear more about it. But I was asked to answer this question in a very important way. Recently, what should Mobile look like? What should visitors see when they come here? What's the first thing they should see? And I'm thinking, you know, the problem is we still have our heads in the Cotswolds. We still think like this is a land of sheep and closely grazed pastures and a relatively dry climate with some mist every now and then. And pretty cool, and not a huge number of species, not too many oaks, you know, so we only have to know 2 or 3 kinds of oaks, because there's only 2 or 3 kinds of oaks, not something crazy like in Alabama where there's 40 species of oaks. Why would you live in a place where there are 40 species of oaks? And that's where we live. And the fact is, it is July in Alabama. And the fact is, in general, it's going to be much warmer. And in general, the winters are going to be less long. And in general, heaven help us, there will be fewer sheep than there are in the Cotswolds. So how do we see this place? And here's the funny part. So we're out there designing landscapes in our yards, everywhere else, that look like landscapes everywhere else. Exactly. Like, they look like something in Ohio. Because, why? Because Ohio looks like something that came out of somebody's heads in the Cotswolds. I'm thinking about this. And Walmart kind of looks like it, except it's even more dinky. So we adopt these shrubs that don't grow very big because things don't grow very fast in the Cotswolds. And it just goes on and on. And so what would a Mobile landscape really look like? And so is it just, could we just go in and substitute a few bushes? Because that's what landscaping is. Oh, let's put in a few bushes. No, we can't. Because we live in a very different place. I don't mean to sound too punchy this morning, but these chiggers, they're getting on me. So let's think about this. What is this Mobile landscape? What should it look like? And it's not about just substituting bushes. It's not just about finding the right lawn. It's about realizing that the lawn is this idea we imported from England, where, in fact, lawns are just kind of easy to maintain. You just go pull in a few voting sheep and ask them to go after it. It's interesting the difference in places. It's interesting to think about that. And it's interesting to think about, gosh, if I really wanted, in a place like Mobile, in a place like Huntsville, in a place like Birmingham or Montgomery, if I really wanted the landscape to reflect where I am, where do I start? And you always start with where you are. And you always start by looking around, not at the other landscapes that we have designed to look like the Cotswolds, or like golf courses in Scotland, but that are designed to, but the places that we haven't designed yet, that we haven't tried to put into some kind of weird compressor to make it look like something in England. I think England's a fine place. It's a great place if you live in England. I don't live there. I don't live there. Neither do you. So we should think more about, what does Alabama look like? What does Mobile look like? Where would we start? Well, we might start in a place like the Mobile Tensaw Delta. Because it's easy for you to see. You're driving over it. And it's some really cool plants, and there's some really beautiful plants, but there's one other thing you should notice about the Mobile Tensaw Delta that's really fundamentally important to understanding what a Mobile landscape is about. It's wet. It's sopping wet. It's very wet. And so if you've created your landscape so that it tries to look like the Cotswolds, which is not very wet and which is very dry and where sheep are very comfortable, you've missed Mobile. And you've missed the glories of these dragonflies spinning around Mobile right now. And those beautiful lilies, and the beautiful grasses, and the incredible cypress trees, and the beautiful longleaf pines, and the savannas underneath those pines that are just full of grasses and wildflowers, and the carnivorous plants of all kinds, which may or may not survive at Splinter Hill, we'll see. You miss all of those things. You got to think about where you are first. Think about the landscape if you want to capture Mobile Think about where we are. Think about how we didn't start in the Cotswolds. We're starting afresh and new. Let's talk about that this morning.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Never ask me to travel with you to another country. I'm a terrible visitor because every place I see, I think, gosh, how can I help? How am I supposed to be involved in this landscape? How do I protect this? How do I discover what's really valuable and good here? Oh boy, what a miserable person to be with. And that's what I think about Alabama. So I have plenty enough here to keep me busy. But it's interesting to think about Alabama, isn't it? And think about what if our landscapes in our lives reflected where we are. What if it wasn't just about attracting outside industry? What if it were about saying, oh wow, how can we make best use of what makes Alabama so distinctive? Because if our industry is based in what makes Alabama so distinctive, maybe it won't be fly by night. Maybe it won't come and go. Because there's no place else that it can be done better. And that's something to think about. I'm thinking about it a lot. What does Alabama look like? It's this beautiful wet place. It's this beautiful warm place. One of the reasons why, and I want to hit this real quickly, one of the reasons we can't be the Cotswolds, and we aren't the Cotswolds. We're not someplace in southern England. We're not a golf course in Scotland. One of the reasons we can't be those places is because of our rainfall and because of the warmth that we have throughout the year, which increases the diversity of many things, trees, shrubs. We've been stable for a long time. That's also very important. Time is a big thing here. But because we stay warm so much of the year, and the ground never really freezes, we have many more pathogens than you would have in other places. And so we have to think about that. And you know, one of the antidotes to having pathogens is to have diversity. What drives diversity in an important way, and this will tease your brain, the reason the tropics are probably more diverse than places farther north is not just a longer growing season, and not just the fact that it doesn't have to deal with cold, but also why couldn't it have just had 30 species of trees in a small area rather than 300 species of trees in a small area in a place like, Central America? And the reason is pathogens. And pathogens drive diversity. And if you're not driving diversity, if you're not increasing your diversity, the pathogens are going to eat you alive. And that's why when we think about our Alabama landscapes, we have to think about, maybe there's a reason we have 40 species of trees, and maybe we should take advantage of 40 species of oaks, and maybe we should take advantage of that. Maybe we should take advantage of other things besides oaks. And maybe we shouldn't think, I'm going to have one kind of grass in my yard. You can get by with that, I would suspect, in the Cotswolds. But even in the Cotswolds, they don't try that. You could probably get by, but even there, we're obsessed with having just one kind of grass. And so you wonder why we have so many diseases. I just want to talk to you about that, and I want you to think about that. What would this landscape be like? Oh, and yes, you bet. I'm going to talk about what this landscape was like when people first came here. Sean and I are going to do that. We finally got together on it. We finally have our heads together. We've been talking about doing something together for a long time, and so we're going to do it. We're going to start doing that. It'll be fun. What was this place like? What was this place like? Frida, thank you for holding on. I'm listening. Tell me what's up.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I recently went on vacation and left my husband unsupervised. He got into my vegetable garden with a Roundup to kill some weeds. So my question is, how long does that Roundup stay in my garden, and when will it be safe to start planting my fall crops, vegetables?
So here's the good thing about Roundup. Of all of the many herbicides you have to worry about that are chemical herbicides, this is the one you have to worry about least. I know that's going to sound weird, but when you start looking at the other herbicides, they can be persistent. They can stay around in some really terrible ways, and they will be persistent in the soil in some really terrible ways. But the thing about Roundup is it doesn't stay active. It only stays active in touch with the green leaves. Now, there are some breakdown products that over time can perhaps cause some problems with soil fauna, the little creatures in the soil. But it is, but that one spraying is not going to have an effect. And in fact, you could go in and plant right now.
Okay. All right. Well, that was good news, because I have been trying to keep my garden pesticide free.
And I think that's a good thing. I think it's very hard to use Roundup in a vegetable garden. And you should forgive your husband if he didn't kill any of your vegetables. That's hard to do. And if he managed to spray this without killing the other vegetables, because anytime any overspray gets on those other vegetables, it will kill them. It probably won't kill you. It probably won't have a terrible effect on you. But it's hard to use Roundup in a vegetable garden. I'll just tell you. You got to be really precise. I guess I should also add, you don't want to overspray. One of the big problems with Roundup is how farmers use it. And they will take a crop like soybeans or corn, and they will breed soybeans and corn so that the soybeans and corn are resistant to the Roundup, and then they will spray the Roundup over those crops to kill the weeds. That can be a problem. So you want to minimize, and that could be a big problem, but you want to minimize. And I think your husband could have done far worse things. I will say that as a husband, I've done far worse things.
Okay, well, my husband's listening in, and he's giving you a high five.
Yeah, great. But tell him, listen, I'm not letting him off the hook, so I'm going to make you happy too. Tell him, don't use Roundup in the garden. Let's come up with some other solutions. There are much better solutions to doing this. And let's think about those. But you're safe. I don't think you'll have any problems. I don't think you'll have to worry about it. If there's any concern, always adding lots of organic matter tends to dilute or tie up any impacts of a lot of chemicals that are used. It usually helps. So make sure you keep your garden well stoked with organic matter. Use that organic matter in a way that it is a good mulch, so that it's a weed killer. If you've got paths through your garden and you've got grass or other things growing in those paths, you want to find every leaf bag you can find on your street and fill those paths up with leaf bags, because the grass won't go through it. Do it high enough so that it's a nice cushiony thing to walk on. And that's a great herbicide. It may be the best herbicide. Works really well.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate your listening to our problem this morning.
Yes, I hope I was sufficiently diplomatic.
You were.
All right. Thank you, Frida. Okay, there we go. I've done some really bad things in my life. I've done some dumb things with herbicides, too. And I learned to regret it. First-hand experience doing dumb things with herbicides. It's possible. Listen, we'll be back. We're going to talk more.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Yeah, there we go. Amy, you always got the greatest questions. We could do a whole show on Amy's questions. I'm going to get to them, Amy. They're pretty good. Oh, yeah. What is the world like in 2075? Oh, my friends. We should think about that soon. What is the world like in 2050? You don't have to go out to 2075. Just click on it 25 years from now. What's it like? What is Mobile like? You think it's going to be exactly the same, huh? Okay. Fun to think about, and Amy's thinking about it. So we're going to come back to that. I have some really good questions. Somebody sent me a beautiful picture of a pawpaw. Who is that? Ultra Runner. And it's grapefruit. A lot of people sending me pictures of their pawpaw fruit now. It's apparently happening. Generally, pawpaws like to be cross-pollinated. They like to be outcrossed. Is there self-pollination going on? I think as we select pawpaws more and more, it's going to be what happens with tomatoes. I think we're probably going to end up with, it's highly likely, and with peaches and with many other things, we're going to end up with pawpaws that are self-pollinating. One of the things that humans do with fruit is this is so weird, and it's hard to explain, and I don't want to take up the whole show doing it, but you should ask me sometime to explain, is that we eliminate sex when it comes to plants. It's one of the first things we do. It's weird. And so with things like bananas, we've eliminated sex, and it's self-pollinating. With tomatoes, we've largely eliminated sex, and it's usually self-pollinating. And in fact, bananas aren't even self-pollinating. They're parthenogenic. It's really fun to talk about all this. We could talk about it over and over. But yes, possibly it is self-pollinating. And it's also possible that you have native pawpaws, not too far, because we keep building in the woods, and it may be not too far away. There were some native pawpaws left that are, in fact, dwarf pawpaws, more than likely. But they could be the same pawpaw species you have, and it could be that maybe pollen will induce pollination, even though the seeds may induce fruit formation, even though the seeds may not be viable. But beautiful pawpaws. We should try them more. B-Dark, so her king squash, which is, I think, B-Dark, I'm with you. Let's just call it king squash. But for those of you who have to purchase the squash, you'll see that it is K-I-N-G space K-I K-A, excuse me, K-I-N-G space K-A space A-E, which is, I think Korean, I guess, I reckon, because it's from Korea, but it's actually a native North American squash that the Koreans developed in a way that we should have done. And it's a beautiful squash, and I love it, and I've been eating a ton of it. And I Vidart planted hers much later, but I said, do it. It's going to be fine. And she's already eating the blossoms, which she had for breakfast, which are beautiful. They're big blossoms, aren't they? And they're really good, and the fruits are really delicious. So she had squash blossoms for breakfast. You have it in an omelet? How did you do that? But it's great. It's a great little squash, wonderful squash. Good to hear that it's doing well for her. I love that squash. I mean, I've tried several others. There are several others out there that I could recommend, but that one's been tops. My wife really likes it too. Early girls hanging in. I think, yeah, it is doing okay. And if we get some cooler air, it might over summer, as we say here, and do okay. Maybe it will do okay. David has a lawn. And there's a depression in it because of the way the sod was put down. I'm not quite sure from the description what the problem is. Doesn't matter. But there's a depression, and it's driving him crazy. So how do you even things out? You'll have a lot of other problems to solve in your lawn, but this one's fairly easy. I would strongly recommend that when you fill that space, and you'll have to do it two or three times this way, but you'll be much better off, fill it with just pine bark. Each piece smaller than your fingernail. Now, that pine bark will break down into soil, but meanwhile, and it will therefore not... If you were to put sand there, it wouldn't compact. It would compact, but it wouldn't... You wouldn't lose, it would level it all out. But the problem is the sand does compact, and it's not a great medium for your lawn to grow in, but the organic matter is perfect. So if you'll just add a bit now, and a bit in late fall, and a bit in spring, and a bit next summer, you'll level that thing out. You can actually put it in there a little higher. If you want to go a little faster at it, put it in a little bit higher. It won't hurt anything. And the grass is going to grow into it very quickly because it's going to love that organic matter. It's going to prefer that organic matter to where it's growing. That may be your best lawn by the time it's done with. Just use pine bark. Each piece, not much bigger than your thumb. If you have a few pieces in there that's as long as your first knuckle, that's okay. But really, you want it all to be about the size of your fingernail. Now, please believe me, I don't manicure my fingernails. That's true. I confess. And so my fingernail is only about an inch and a half long. There you go. And 20 people will probably start pollution themselves. Well, I mean, we're doing the pollution one way or another right now, I think, B-Dark. How does a wetland, this is going to be so many questions. So Amy wants me to talk about what did Alabama look like when the early botanists came through. Well, first off, and we're going to talk about this with Sean. We're going to do a whole show on it. But, Amy asked, so I get to talk about it anyway. What did Alabama look like? And I think it's important to know that when the first botanists came through, Alabama had already been a place that had seen people for 16,000 years. The first Alabamians weren't from the Cotswolds. I know that's what we think. The first Alabamians were from many places, but not the Cotswolds. We basically drove the descendants of those people out of Alabama for the most part. But they had been here, and they had been affecting the place too. And that's important to understand. They didn't affect it in the same way we affect it now. And I can show you. It's really interesting. It's one of the things we're working on at the Research Center. I always say we're not studying at the Research Center where I work, where we're studying trees. We're not studying just trees. We always have to study people. No matter what you do in nature, you have to study people. Because people have been here a long time. They've been having an impact for a long time. You have to understand what that impact was, because sometimes they didn't understand that impact. And we still don't understand our impact. Oh, it's incredible. I hate to say it this way, but my dad always said it to me in one way or another. You know, we don't smell our own stink. It's one of our big problems as people. And so people have been here for a long time. They've been affecting the landscape. But when the first botanists came through, there was an immediate period of time when humans were not affecting the landscape as much. For a lot of reasons, I won't go into the details, but say in the 18th century, early 18th century, 1700s, when Mobile was founded, there were certainly people living around Mobile, a lot of people living around Mobile, before the Bienvilles and all of that crowd came and acted like they were here first. And they had missed about 17,000 years of history in that whole process. But what did it look like? So I want to, let me just get to this real quickly because it's kind of interesting. Let's just take Mobile. Because Alabama is a huge state. It was vastly different when you go 50 miles, 100 miles. It would have changed over and over and over again because it is the center of tree diversity in North America. It's the center of fish diversity in North America. It's the center of mussel diversity in the temperate world. It's the center of hickory diversity globally. It's the center of, it goes on and on. It's an incredibly diverse place, and not every place, even in Alabama, is the same. But what did Mobile look like? Let's start there, because that's what Amy is kind of asking, I think, maybe initially. And one of the biggest differences that I think, what would be the one of the big surprises? Well, there'd be two big surprises. One, there weren't many live oaks. Live oaks would have been very narrowly focused along certain habitats. We know that. In fact, we've got documentation of that. In fact, a guy who really sadly did much to... compromise Alabama, a guy named Andy Jackson. Andy Jackson told Congress, I've been to Alabama. I'd seen it there. And let me tell you, but what happened was is that they actually did a survey and they found out that live oaks were not that common around Alabama. And they actually had to create areas in the early 19th century that were dedicated to live to growing live oaks so that they would have enough live oaks for the ships. Because there weren't that many live oaks. There were a lot more pines. Pines would have been dominant. And not the pines we see now, but longleaf slash pines, which are beautiful pines when they're native. They're incredible. It would have been everywhere. There would have been lots of fire. There would have been lots of savannas, even in Mobile. Mobile was not so much a broadleaf forest, a hardwood forest. It was a savanna. It was a place where trees are rather open. They're not too close together. They're pretty far apart. There's grasses and wildflowers underneath them because there's all sorts of sunlight. That would have been huge. It would have been a major difference. A lot of those areas would have been very wet. They would have been pitcher plant bogs. There were pitcher plant bogs everywhere. There were flatwoods, which were essentially pitcher plant bogs at a very large scale. There would have been dune-like savannas where it would have been moderately dry, but it was a very complicated place. And what? Here's the other cool thing. Bamboo. Bamboo everywhere. Bartram describes bamboo. We're going to come back and talk about it because it's so interesting.
Mm-hmm. me and my best friend Lillian in her blue Deckhound all giddy, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Yeah, and bamboo everywhere. Isn't that a cool? Mobile. Native. It wasn't from Asia. It wasn't fishing pole bamboo. It wasn't the yellow bamboo we call fishing pole bamboo, the one we make fishing poles out of. It was our native bamboo. We call it cane. Some people call them cane brakes. So William Bartram. Amy, listen. Get Bartram's Travels. It's an incredible book. It was published in the early 19th century. It was very influential when it was. And Bartram's Travels described coming through Mobile and other places in the South. And they're fascinating descriptions of Florida, of the Carolinas, of Georgia. It's really a remarkable book. It was so remarkable in its day that it influenced poets all around the world. So some of the great poets, and some of you may have heard me say this, but it bears repeating. If you had to memorize Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner or Kubla Khan, you're going to see the influence of Bartram in a lot of that. Particularly in Kubla Khan, we know specifically that he had just read Bartram's Travels and had just read an episode where Bartram had come through Florida and through Alabama. And Kubla Khan, in an amazing way, uses language that was almost exactly like the language that Bartram uses to describe the forest in the Mobile Tensaw Delta, which were big. They were immense. High, high overhead, as Coleridge Taylor would say. Isn't that interesting? The descriptions of Mobile were influencing the poets of England. They weren't thinking about, they thought the Cotswolds were pretty boring. They wanted to see a really exotic place like Alabama. They wanted Alabama to be Alabama. It was the paradise. It was kind of a tropical paradise, if you will, for those folks. It was interesting, and Bartram's Travels played a role in that. But there were huge stands of canebrake in the Tensaw Delta, and particularly around the area that I call Bartram's Forest, which has just been preserved by the Nature Conservancy, along with the help of Patagonia. Around Doctor's Lake, a lot of people know that lake. I've been involved with working on that lake since I first did a story about access to that lake many years ago. And the canebrake there was incredible. And it stretched for many miles. And the cane was, there was a story that Bartram brought back a cane, a piece of, or Bartram described cane that was 40 feet tall. Immense in places. And we would think that people say, oh, it couldn't have been that big. But in fact, we have another example. When a guy named Bernard Romans came through and brought a cane that he cut out of the Mobile Tensaw Delta and brought it to the governor, who is then maybe the Spanish governor. I don't know. Don't ask me. Which one of them governors. As a gift, and it was 40-something feet long. These are big things. They're really cool things. Really neat things. So that was hugely different, these cane breaks. And the cane breaks would have been filled with Carolina parakeets. Oh, God, it hurts me sometimes to think about it. And passenger pigeons would have used those cane brakes. There would have been bison, maybe even Bartram's time, there would have been some bison left in those cane brakes, even around Mobile. probably there were jaguar up until the early 18th century around Mobile. Yep, that's right. That's right. We stop them at the customs on the border and don't let them through anymore, but the jaguar were here pretty freely. We know that there were, we know they were here. They were as far north as Huntsville, because we've got some great examples of jaguars in caves, probably in during the historic period, probably after the last ice age. And it's really cool. Really cool that that all these things existed. It was a very different place, and we'll talk about it more. But that's pretty cool. Okay, B-Dark, you got to supply me with this information, because I don't want you to write me next week and say it, oh, yeah, so let me know. Just let me know how many feet, because I got to figure out whether, if that tree is far enough, if that tree's got some problems, there's no question. B-Dark sent me a picture of a tree. It's a big pine tree. It's a bit of a tangle. There's some easy ways to get it less of a tangle, but it's also got some damage at the top that is going to make it more vulnerable to more damage. If it's far enough away from the house, it might be okay. But we need to think carefully if it's close to the house. That's my biggest thing. Yeah, that's the biggest thing. Welcome to Circle K. Reply, we've been infiltrated, folks. We've been infiltrated by Circle K's reply yes to subscribe. I don't know how that happens. So there's not a clear question there. Morning, Bill. I'm seeing a lot of Moss in my St. Augustine. I sprayed this yesterday. It doesn't say it's for grass. Is this what I should use? Yes, it can work very well. He's using Monterey BT spray. It could be that the tropical, what do they call them, tropical side webworm moths are beginning to come in again. If you're seeing very large numbers, you want to do it about a week after you begin seeing those very large numbers, because that's when the caterpillars are going to start. How bad is it going to be? Well, it could be reflected in how many moths that you see. But BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, can work very well on those caterpillars if you spray it. You'll probably have to do it more than once, but you don't want to do it every day. And you don't have to get every one, because a few are not going to do a lot of damage. You just want to sort of take the steam out of the invasion of tropical side webworms. I'm assuming that's what you're seeing. I'm assuming they should be very small, but you'll see lots and lots of them. If you just see a few moths here and there, you don't worry about it. Yeah. David Crockett was called a man of the cane as an insult in his time in D.C. Yeah, and so canebrake extended from Kentucky through Tennessee along the Tennessee Basin, all the way deep along the Mobile Basin, all throughout the state. And now we know that Alabama is the center of cane diversity in North America. Center of native bamboo diversity. We have four species. We're actually doing the genetics to see if we may have more species. And I wouldn't at all be surprised if the genetics show that we have more than one species. One of the problems of distinguishing cane is that they don't flower very often, so you kind of, sometimes it helps to wait until they flower. But there are other things we're using now. There are other tools we're using now.
Have you ever sleepy dead? Go on, people, day to buy. Have you ever
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Yeah, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Well, it's kind of trending the way I hoped it would this morning. We are talking a lot about if we didn't live in the Cotswolds in our head. If we didn't think the ideal vacation, the ideal place to spend time is a golf course in Scotland, what would Alabama look like? It wouldn't look like a golf course in Scotland. It wouldn't look like the Cotswolds. That's what I said. You know, it's a different place, England, but yet that is how we view where we are. It's had a huge influence on our landscapes. And now our landscapes are all based on Walmart. It's just, you know, it's like, oh, well, here's another Walmart landscape. Let's put some native, let's sub some native plants so that it'll make it look like Mobile. My friends, Walmart, I don't care what plants you put in there, don't look like Mobile. Well, it does now, unfortunately. Looks a lot like Baldwin County, unfortunately. But that's not what's really distinctive about where we are, is it? So we're thinking about what would it look like? How do we do that? It's not just about subbing plants. It's about thinking about where we are. It's about thinking about why it's different. It's about thinking how the climate's different. It's about thinking why you could settle for two or three oak species in England, but you got to think about 40 oak species in Alabama, and you really do have to think about them very seriously. And you got to think about, 12, 13 species of hickories, and you got to think about them very seriously. You don't even think about hickories in England because they don't have them. I mean, we're the global center of hickory diversity. Why wouldn't we have hickories here? We're the national center of magnolia diversity. Those are all really important trees. But we're also the national center of bamboo diversity. Cane, we call it. Really cool. And so we had these big, giant cane breaks. We're also Mobile County. I don't know if it is anymore because things are changing rapidly and because we're not kind to where we are. And we don't think about our impact. Mobile was probably the center of grass diversity east of the Mississippi. And by that I mean it wasn't that we had St. Augustine, Bermuda, and no, none of those. We're talking about 200 and something species of grasses, maybe more. I'll have to look that up. I'll have to count them one day. It's a huge list of grasses that were native to Mobile. And all of that was really important to where we are. Important to understanding. Alabama's the center of pitcher plant diversity, this incredible carnivorous plant globally. Terrestrial pitcher plants. We're one of the great centers of carnivorous plant diversity just generally. We're the center of sunflower diversity, most likely. All those incredible things. But how do we think about it? Well, we think about it as a wet place. I want to emphasize this because you don't think about it enough. Because I know you don't think about it enough because you're still putting in irrigation systems that were designed for Arizona, and you're putting them on a timer that was based on timing to keep grasses growing in Arizona. Arizona, my friends, gets 15, 12, 15 inches of rain a year. They don't need to be growing grass. Not sod. I don't know that we do either. But if we were going to grow it, you don't want to irrigate it at the same rate you'd irrigate in Arizona. In fact, you really only need to irrigate like 4 or 5 times a year. So do you need a irrigation system for that? Maybe, if you're super lazy. I didn't say that. But yeah, I mean, you only need to turn the irrigation. You could put a sprinkler out. Once you get your lawn established, it would be the same thing. This is how weird it is. This is how little we know about where we are. Mobile gets 70 inches of rain a year. You know what? Washington, D.C. gets a little over 40. Seattle Airport gets around 40. Maybe less, 38 inches, I think. There it is. It's a different place, ain't it? And we ought to think about it like it's a different place. And one of the things, and when we're creating our yards, we did everything we can to drain all the wetlands when we built Mobile, and they were everywhere. And I reckon if you're going to build parking lots and all those things, you got to drain the wetlands. But you know what? We still have places where it's still going to rain. We're still going to collect water. Make use of it. Think about a wetland as an asset in your yard, because much of our flowering diversity, much of our beautiful flowers, much of what we, just this incredible array of lilies and irises and Ludwigia and sunflowers and reeds, it goes on and on. Oh, goodness gracious, hibiscus. I mean, Mobile should be the hibiscus city. We have so much hibiscus diversity. It's unbelievable. And when was the last time you saw a commercial landscape with hibiscus in it? I know you hadn't seen one with native. But we don't think about that. Why don't we? Because we don't know where we are. We're still in the Cotswolds. Let's think about Mobile. How is it different? How do we create these landscapes that reflect Mobile? Reflect Mobile. Some people say growing native plants is easier. They don't require as much maintenance. But you know what? We've changed the landscape to the point that, in fact, the native landscapes may require as much maintenance as the invasive stuff. Probably more than the invasive stuff we put in. I mean, you want an easy-to-care-for landscape, just turn it over to the Kogan grass. you'll never have anything else. You'll never have to worry. You just have to mow the Kogan grass at a certain height. Can't mow it too low. You have to mow it a certain, and you know, there it is. But our native stuff is easy to maintain if we think about where it came from and the soils, and if we can recreate those conditions, which is not hard to do. Not hard to do. Just think about where you are. Think about, it's going to look different. It's going to be different. That's the beautiful thing about being from Alabama. It's the beautiful thing about being from Mobile. It does not look like the Cotswolds. Sorry. I'm beating up on the Cotswolds today. I doesn't deserve it. There's a lot of nice sheep there. And some good people. Boy, I've met some good people. And some great novels. Jane Austen. I mean, I even like Jane Austen. What a great... I mean, it's really fun. If you're looking for something to read... I told my mother the other day. She said, I don't know what to read anymore. I'm bored. I can't find any. Read Jane Austen. She'll love it. Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Northanger Abbey. Oh, they're really cool. All right, what else we got? How do we get to see what's native? What you have seen? Where can the public go to see this? One of the great places to see it is driving along the causeway. And if you know, I shouldn't be allowed to drive. Because I'm always looking around and seeing what's around me. And, you know, if somebody wants to take away my license, I guess they could. And I probably wouldn't complain that much. But if you look around, if you find a place to pull over and just look around at that delta and some of the flowering, and look at the white, look at the lilies when they're in bloom, they're incredible. And look at the hibiscus in the native swamps that are left around. You think there are any left around Orange Beach? I hope there are. In those wetlands there, the brackish wetlands, the freshwater wetlands, they're incredible there. Where do you go to see all this diversity? One of the nice things is if you can see the savannah diversity at Mobile Botanical Gardens. I think that's a great place to see it. You can also see it at Splinter Hill Bog, which is really nice. I hope it stays that way. I think there are reasons to believe it won't.
My girl, don't lie.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 1065.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Be dark. Let me say, you don't want to clean up some of those vines. You want to clean up all those vines. If you're not going to trim that tree out, you want to clean up all those vines. If you could get somebody to just take, you know, well, it's just 40 feet from the house means that it probably does less damage if it falls. There's a less of a chance. It's a little better off. You're a little better off. But those limbs are going to keep growing, and that's what worries me. But meanwhile, there's a good bit of rot there, and meanwhile, you're creating sale area. And unless you get rid of all of them, you're going to miss the ones that are creating the most sale area. It's really hard to manage vines in a tree like that. It's lovely to have vines in a tree that you don't care whether it falls or not. But this tree is close enough that you got to worry about it a little bit. So I'm just saying, that's something that's in your hands to do. And then we can actually look at the tree a little better and get a better sense of how bad it is at the top. B-Dark sent me a picture of a tree, and I often recommend not planting a tree within 50 feet of your house if it's a big tree. I don't care whether it's a live oak. I might say cypress might be okay, but cypress will get topped out too. They probably won't do as much damage as a live oak or other things, but they can cause problems. Unless it's a palm. If palms are great, small trees are great within the house, but a large tree, you could put a small tree, you know, close enough to for the leaves to touch the house if you think that's a good idea. I'm not sure that's a great idea, but you could do that, and it probably is not going to be a huge thing. But large trees in a... Did y'all know we had hurricanes? Has anyone mentioned that before? Did they happen to tell you that we have tropical storms and that they occur with annual frequency? Oh, I hope they did. Because they're serious and they're big and they have a huge impact. And you might skirt them for a few years and you think, oh, it's okay, I'm all over, because the, you know, life only goes on for like 5 years at a time. But no, it doesn't. In fact, there's these big events. Yeah. Oh, B-Dark, I didn't think you planted the tree. I didn't think so at all. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to imply that. I knew you didn't plant that tree. It's a caution. If you're building a house, having a tree within 50 feet can be a problem. Whether you planted it, whether it was already there. In fact, it may be a bigger problem if it was already there. I had a big, beautiful magnolia that was within 50 feet of the house. Just barely, but right about 50 feet from the house. And that thing, if it came crashing down... And magnolias are not good about... I mean, they actually hold up pretty well from the roots, but their upper branches can come... I had that thing carefully trimmed. I had laurel oaks and other things, which are just terrible, notorious for being bad trees that cause problems. And water oaks. And I don't allow them within 50 feet of my house. This is a loblolly pine. It, pretty sure it is. It can get a lot of rot issues, and it can go over from the roots. And so you see what happens if it goes over from the roots. And sometimes that rot goes all the way from the top down into the roots. Good. There we go. So we have been talking a lot about native plants. But more importantly, we need to talk about native environments, because that's what you need to be creating around your yard. And sometimes you don't use native plants to do that, and that's probably okay in most cases. Like, I got a fig. You think a fig's native? Nah. I mean, we brought figs in pretty early on, but they ain't native. I love figs. Figs are great. They're wonderful. I got citrus. You know, I've had citrus. You think citrus are native? Nah. But it's all right to have some around your house. That's fine. But you got to think about the environment that that tree is planted in. You got to understand where it came from. You got to understand where it's going. You got to understand how mobile it is. You got to understand how it's different. You got these beautiful azaleas, these big, beautiful evergreen azaleas. Every one of them, every evergreen azalea we've ever grown in Mobile came from other places. You can call them Southern Indian azaleas. You can call them Mobile azaleas. You can give them all sorts of names. They're not native. They came from other places. Should you grow them? Yeah, sure, why not? But you got to think about where they came from. You got to think about how this place is different. You got to think about the azaleas that are from areas in Japan and China that have a climate similar to ours, because if you get the azaleas that come from places in northern China or Korea where the climate is much colder, they may not do that well here. And in fact, we still make that mistake a lot. So it's the environment we're thinking about when we think about native. It's not just the plants. It's the environment. How are we creating a native environment around us? Because ultimately, folks, if you don't think about that dirty word that we're not allowed to say anymore in public, but I'm going to say to you right here, if you don't think about climate and how our climate's different than the climate in Ohio and the climate in the Cotswolds, and the climate in New England, you done missed the boat. You missed the boat. It's about understanding where you are. And then saying, God, what were the choices among those great native plants, and how can they be used here? Oh, let's just start with hibiscus, which is a great place to start. And they don't have to live in wetlands, but it's a great way to manage them. And iris, beautiful iris, these incredible, the things we call Louisiana iris, which are David Hummel, I'm sorry to say. David might allow me to say this. They're native to Alabama as well in many cases. And how do we make use of those? And these beautiful lilies, like the Delta lilies, the Hymenocallis lilies, and the other lilies that we call spider lilies, which I have to explain what it is because we call everything spider lilies. But there's beautiful plants out there in the Delta that are blooming now, and they're really incredible. And they do really well in wetland soils. And if you had a slightly wet spot, they would do great there. And that wet spot would actually keep you from having weed problems with some other plants. Isn't that neat? Yes, so David gave me permission to describe these iris as Gulf Coast iris. David, I don't mean to take too many. Listen, let me say that New Orleans was the center of iris diversity in North America. Incredible. Incredible diversity. That was what it was. Ninth Ward basically wiped out. When that was developed out, it was filled in. Probably wiped out a lot of that diversity. It was incredible what was described there. Unbelievable. The colors, the diversity, the variety. But some of that's still here around New Orleans, along the Mississippi coast, up the Mississippi River, back into Alabama and into Florida. Incredible iris diversity. Beautiful iris. Great things. But you know what? You got to think about where they came from. And if you want to manage them, think about the fact that we get a lot of rainfall and that you got to deal with that rainfall. How do you do that in your own yard? Ooh, isn't that fun? Pretty cool. David Hubble, I see you've been consorting with some pretty well-known chefs. You'll have to tell us about it pretty soon. We'll have to, David, you and I got to talk. We have to catch up at some point. Sean asked me, is it illegal to gather seeds at Gulf State Park? That's the kind of question that I'd almost not like to answer. But I'm going to try to answer it when we come back.
Sugar Magnolia, blossoms blooming. That's all empty and I don't care.
So my baby down by the river.
Who she might to come up soon for care.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 1065.
Yeah, all right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. So this question about whether you can collect seed from state property. Alabama has a weird seed acquisition code. That is relatively complicated. I think it was designed to keep people from, for example, collecting hemp seed, which is pot, and trying to grow it out as pot or something. I don't know. It's bizarre. I mean, there's a line in there about it. It really wasn't designed to protect native plant sources. It's pretty clear to me. I think they were maybe also trying to protect people like Syngenta, who are producing seeds for farmers, if Syngenta exists. But places like that that are producing patented seed from farmers, and they probably lobbied to get this, which keeps you from collecting genetically engineered cottonseed, for example. So it's really not clear what they're trying to get at. But technically, yes, it is illegal. And there have been times when the state parks have been pretty adamant about it. Is it easy to get a form to collect seed in state on state lands? It depends. I think the state parks are they're probably easier about it. I don't know. But you really technically should get permission before collecting seed from a state park or from other state lands. I don't want to go into it. I'm just going to say technically you should. Is there anybody out there enforcing it? No. Should you care about how you collect seeds? Yes. And that's the important thing. When you collect seeds, no matter where you are, you want to collect in a way that doesn't disturb the native source population. Because you really can over-collect seed from a population, and then it doesn't reproduce very well. And then we lose that population. I mean, Am I going to say this out loud? I found some ginseng the other day. I'm not going to say where. Oh, it was somewhere on the planet. And I thought, gosh, you know, how long has it been since I've seen ginseng? And it's because people didn't care. People didn't care about their impact of collecting things. And we lost Sang. We lost it as a plant, as a functional plant. It used to be all over. But even collecting seeds can have a big impact. So you want to collect no more than 10% of the seed in any place. And you got to expect that some other goofball is going to come by, like me, and collect another 10%. So you need to be very careful and very cautious when you collect seed from any place. You want to collect from a lot of different plants. You don't want to collect it all in one place, if you can help it. A lot of things to think about when collecting seeds. I don't want to discourage you from collecting seeds, because I think it's very valuable and it's something we need to be doing. But you want to be careful. And yes, there are some legalities. You can read the Administrative Code Rule 80-10-21-.35. There you go. Study it. Tell me what it means. I don't know. It's hard to tell. So what else we got here? That I've missed. Shortleaf, you know, my other friend, David Michael, asked me to talk more, a little more about short leaf, and we will. It's one of those trees that we really, for those of you in the Huntsville area, you think you have seen the original forest. You haven't, because shortleaf savannas were as rich above in the plateaus above Huntsville as they were down in, as the longleaf was down in Mobile. And shortleaf pine savannas are really cool, and it's one of the great missing ingredients, along with canebrake, which was also frequent in the Tennessee Basin. So it's a really important thing, because it was so much a part of what we are, and we've forgotten about it. And it was a really cool plant. And some of you folks up in Huntsville ought to call and ask me about shortleaf pine and what it means and what we should be doing about it and why we're losing it and why we may continue to lose it, because if we don't watch where we step. But it was really important part of the ecosystem, and something that's almost impossible to see now. You know, Amy wants me to help her see these things, and I do too. I want us to find these places, but you know, we've stomped around so much that it's even hard to find these native landscapes anymore, except in a few dramatically big areas like the Mobile Tensaw Delta. But that doesn't capture even a little bit of the great diversity that was Alabama. It's just a small, fractional part of it. Not even the most diverse part. I know what people tell you about it being the most diverse part. It's not. It's not. Not even by a long shot. It's a cool place. It's got very different diversity. But the most diverse places in Alabama have mostly been lost. You go to Splinter Hill Bog, you'll see more diversity in Splinter Hill Bog than you probably will see in the entire Mobile Tensaw Delta, at least where plants are concerned. And, you know, you got 200,000, 250, 300,000 acres against a few hundred acres. And the diversity in pitcher plant bogs is just so out of the roof. And that's not the Delta. How do you think about it? It's really interesting. Well, we're going to talk more about it. Sean and I are going to do this show. We're going to think about those kinds of things. We're going to think about them in fun ways. We're not only, Sean wants me to talk about, like Amy does, what was it like when, you know, 1800s, 1700s. And I'm going to say, okay, I want to know what it was like when people first came here. Because if we don't understand that, we don't understand anything. We're not going to be able to make this thing work. We're not going to be able to reconstruct this. We're not going to understand how things got to be like they are. And when I say when people first came, we're talking now 17,000 years ago. We still had elephants. Don't you want to ask me, what do you mean elephants? You feel free to call me and say, what do you mean elephants? Yeah, we had elephants. We had camels, native camelids. We had horses. We had tapirs. We had all those things. And it wasn't that long ago when people first came here. It really wasn't. It was a long time ago in some ways, but not in most ways. And in fact, Alabama is still recovering from that loss that occurred about 12,000 years ago when people began having a huge impact on the landscape in terms of the megafauna. We'll talk about that. Sean and I are going to talk about that. Probably won't get into all of it today. So there are some great tours of the Delta that it's worthwhile taking, and it's worthwhile going at multiple times a year. Delta gets started up, cranks up slowly in spring, but by mid-April, because it's so wet, and the water stays cool, and so it starts later in spring than a lot of places. But from mid-April on, it's a really cool place to visit. Others, you know, the Bidens are going to be coming up in fall, the sunflower. It's really cool. Some really nice things going on out there. B-Dark is asking me, how old do I think her pine tree is? And this is always a really important question, because things grow very fast. We don't live in the Cotswolds. B-Dark, you're going to hate me when I keep saying Cotswolds. But I just thinking about it, because it's where our minds are. even if we don't mean to be, we still think like, oh, things grow very slow in England. Well, they do, but they don't grow slow here. That tree is probably not that old. I'd say, I'm going to put 50 years on it. I might give you 50 years. If you cut it down, you can count the rings. You could tell me I'm wrong. But that tree is, it's a big pine tree. Looks big. Looks impressive. Been broken off the top. Started growing out in funky sort of ways. That's what worries me about it. But it's probably not 50 years old. Grow fast, die young. How long will it live? Probably a maximum of about 70 to 125 years. In that situation, I would give it, I would be generous to say it'll live 70 years. So, just something to think about. What kinds of elephants and camels? Was that a prompt? Did I get a prompt out of that? Yeah, there it is. So it's really cool. What kind of elephants? Amy, you're almost making me forget about my chiggers. So here's the thing. We had elephants. We had three kinds of elephants. We had the mammoths that were in the southeast. I don't remember the particular species. We had the mastodons, which are here, which were probably, I think, more common here than the mammoths, but they were both here. And they weren't just woolly. I mean, they probably had hair, but there were probably a lot of different races. We know that we're here. We got their bones. They're all over. We actually have bones with arrowheads in them. Are mastodons and mammoths elephants? You betcha. Are Indian elephants elephants? You betcha. Are African elephants elephants? You betcha. They're just in different places, right? Asian elephants. But they're all in the group elephants. And they're very much elephants. Except I would have to say our elephants were probably cooler than African elephants. Oh, heavens. And then we had gomphotheres. I think there's good evidence that the gomphotheres, don't have those big impressive tusks. They have rather interesting tusks that are very different and shorter trunks, perhaps, but they were probably, they really made an impact on things. They were here. There you go. And camels. So all those llamas in South America and alpacas and guanacos. Did I say that right? Llamas. Llamas. All those, you know where they came from? You know where their ancestor was from? Southeastern United States. Yep. You know where the camels in Turkey came from? North America. This is where camels evolved. And so there were all of these great, incredible camelids here. And people wiped them out. And what do you think the consequences on the landscape was? It's still feeling it. And that's something worth talking about.
FM Talk 106.5, home for plain living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Mr. Plott says, of course, our native Alabama elephants were much cooler. Not only did they have really cool long trunks and cool extra long tusks, they wore red sweaters. All right, I did it for you, Mr. Plott. There you go. Yeah, so maybe, you know, every time you see that elephant in the red sweater, think about the fact that This was a place of elephants. Imagine that. And imagine that the forest was shaped by that and had adapted to that. And now think, oh, what happened when they left? And what happened when we had three species? I'm not supposed to be going on about this because Sean and I are going to talk about this. We're going to have a special show. We're going to do this. We're going to do it together. It's going to be pretty cool. Sean, I'm giving advertising for this because it'll be neat. It'll be fun to talk about. All these weird things that happen in Alabama that you never even thought about, maybe. And what it was like and how it got to be like it is. And what that means about how we deal with it now. It's certainly, I think about, every time I go out in the forest and I think, why is this happening? And I think, okay, I got to think about elephants. You betcha. You think I don't? I do. And it's very illuminating. And we can think about what that means. I didn't talk about, Amy, I didn't talk about horses, which is really important. Because where did horses evolve? In Asia? No. Europe? No. Horses evolved in the Southeast and the Southwest United States. And we wiped them all out. So we got a tooth. I got a tooth on our research center. I got a tooth from a stilt-legged horse in a cave. How'd it get there? I'll let you figure out how a horse's tooth got in a cave. But I have my suspicions, along with bison teeth and other things that frequently show up in caves, and skulls and other things. Yeah, I think the stilt-legged horse, pretty cool, isn't that? And that existed before horses in Asia existed. And this is where they evolved. And they went across the Bering Land Bridge over into Asia much late in the process and continued to evolve there. And we wiped them out here and kept them in Asia. I don't know why they were so smart to keep them in Asia and we were so not smart to keep them here. I don't have contact with those people who did that, but they were the first Alabamians. We can blame them, but I don't think we're any better. Sorry. Pretty cool to think about, though, isn't it? So, B-Dark says, live fast, die young. So feels like she's got something in common with that tree. Yeah. So, she feels like she may actually be B-Dark. I shouldn't say that. Maybe the same age as that tree. Makes you feel something in common with it. But it's a dangerous tree, so be careful around it. She's got a tree in her yard. She wants to know what to do about it. What else have we missed this morning? We, in the midst of talking about all this, here's where I'm going to bring it back. We need to think about where we are when we plant our yards. We need to think about all that past history, but even if we just think about what is a native landscape, look, just look at the rainfall and think, gosh, does the amount of rainfall we get here make a difference? Does the fact that it never drops below 80 degrees during July, does that make a difference? You bet. What difference does that have on tomatoes? Well, it has a huge impact on tomatoes. Does it drop below 80 degrees in Ohio in July? Yes, it does. And that's why they can keep producing tomatoes during July. It makes a difference thinking about this thing called climate. And is climate changing? Yes, it is. It's changing more in other parts of the country, and so they're beginning to look more like Alabama, and they're going to need our expertise even more. And so the shame is we don't understand where we are, and we can't offer that expertise. Understanding where we are, it's a commodity, it's an asset. It's something we should think about. It's something we should think about when we design our commercial landscapes. It's something we should think about when we design our home landscapes. It's something we should think about when we plant our tomatoes. It's something we should think about when we're saying, oh, I think I ought to have native plants. Well, what's a native plant? What did it look like? Something we should think about when we plant live oaks everywhere, because they weren't everywhere originally. They were only in narrowly restricted areas, and now that we're planting them everywhere, what's going to happen? Well, let me tell you, when you go overboard planting one thing in a climate that's diverse in diseases and diverse in pathogens and pests, what's going to happen? You better think about it. You better think about it carefully. Because we're not Ohio. We're not the Cotswolds. We're not a golf course in Scotland. And we should quit trying to act like that and quit trying to look like that. We should embrace what we are in Alabama. For the first time. Your grandparents didn't do it. Shoot, I'm your grandparents. I know it. So I can speak for them. My grandparents didn't do it, and I love them. I love them. But they barely understood where they are. They understood a few things, maybe, that we don't understand. But, you know, I loved them. But they didn't understand where they were. And their grandparents before them didn't understand where they were because they all thought they were still living in the Cotswolds. So this is sort of the theme of the show today. It's a theme of our show every week. It's just that the chiggers have gotten me all ramped up, and I thought I ought to go on about it a little bit. But there we go. And B-Dark is also saying, look, I got another thing in this common with this tree. It's not just that we both live fast and die young. It's not just that we're about the same age. He said, heck, I'm dangerous too. B-Dark, you always hit it right on the head. There you go. I love it. I'm in favor of the Tassie Tiger, but that's a different story in my book. Yes. The dire wolves, well, it's a made up thing, but they were here probably. But we had lots of other things. And we'll talk about that. We even had American lions here, which is a really weird thing to think about. And I'm not talking about panthers. I'm talking about American lions. And they probably played a huge role in the ecosystem. We're going to come back. We'll talk about it soon.
I want to pick my peace. Pick up everything on the front. You got to get down. On your bended knees. I ain't going to. I dig no more taters. I decline. I ain't going to pick no peace. Because everything is on the phone, you know you got to go.